You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the December 2023, January 2024 combined issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Here's the continuation of A House Divided by Anna Peel. The same month, Glanville's attorney sent Warner Brothers a letter that read the entire incident was comprised of some flirtatious conduct and kissing between Ms. Manzo and Ms. Glanville, and all of it was absolutely mutual and consensual, and called for it to release all footage. Glanville says she and Manzo were never alone, and no one from production stepped in at any point. Glanville had behaved similarly on a previous season of UGT. Glanville says NBCU executives sent positive feedback to the cast. Cast member Phaedra Parks told Vanity Fair she was sober that evening and observed Glanville and Manzo's interaction as nothing short of a modern-day harlequin romance. Love was winning. "You're not in your right mind, and you want to give them good TV," says Glanville. "The whole point of these shows is to get us unhinged. If there was an issue or situation where someone was uncomfortable in Morocco, no one in production or the crew or cast intervened in the moment." Glanville says she heard nothing until she started posting about Bravo and UGT on social media while she was hospitalized for inflammation in October, at which point she got a text from Barry Goldstein, whom she had never heard of, telling her he was a psychologist who wanted to call her for a check-in. Bravo recently announced the season will premiere in 2024, though a source with knowledge of executives' decisions says the network is still discussing whether it will air at all. On October 20th, Manzo's lawyer filed suit on behalf of Marco Vega against NBCU, Bravo, Peacock, Warner Brothers, Shed, and Forest Productions, a subsidiary of Shed. Vega, who was an on-screen butler on a UGT arc, alleges Glanville sexually harassed Vega and that Parks smacked his bottom. Defendants allowed, condoned, and even encouraged Ms. Glanville's sexually aggressive and offensive conduct on others on the sets, the suit says. Warner Brothers does not comment on pending litigation. Other reality shows at other networks have had to make corrections. The Bachelor reportedly instituted a two-drink-an-hour restriction after two intoxicated Bachelor in Paradise cast members reportedly had an on-camera sexual encounter. On the British dating show Love Island, past cast members have said they're allowed 2 units of alcohol a day, and rigorous mental health protocols were put in place following the suicides of 2 former cast members and the show's longtime host, which I wrote about for this magazine. On Netflix's Love is Blind, a dating series with single-season cast, a cast member accused producers of not supporting her with mental health care, although emails showed to Vanity Fair that she was offered post-show therapy. This month, a cast member filed a lawsuit asserting she was sexually assaulted while under 24-hour surveillance and no producers intervened. Chris Kalin, the creator of Love is Blind and CEO of Kinetic Content, told People that cast are not filmed or managed around the clock and that we can't be accountable if someone doesn't tell us that they have a concern. On Kinetic shows like Love is Blind, The Ultimatum, and Married at First Sight, Professionals interview each cast member prior to filming to evaluate whether they're in a headspace to be on and subsequently off reality television. Similar protocols are in place on Love Island, The Bachelor, and MTV's The Challenge. Frankel says she underwent emotional and psychological testing during casting for The Apprentice, which aired on NBC. A source with knowledge of the casting process clarified that while psych evaluations take place for competition series like Top Chef and Project Runway, unstructured, unscripted series like The Real Housewives only require partners to have already cast talent speak with a psychologist in a meeting NBCU calls Intro to Psych. McSweeney, Williams, and Frankel say they did not talk to a mental health professional before filming a Bravo show, though a source with knowledge says McSweeney and Williams completed Intro to Psych. Two other housewives told me they had Intro to Psych phone sessions with Goldstein, but in their view that the calls did not achieve the stated goal of establishing rapport with the show Psych early on. The general murkiness about the level and type of care provided extends to the language of the guidelines. A representative for Shedd says that going forward, cast members will have even more touch points with show psychologists. Bunim Murray Productions, President Julie Pizzi, oversees The Challenge, one of the few long-running reality shows outside Bravo with a repertory cast. Bunim Murray is the production company that brought us The Real World and Road Rules via MTV. The Challenge has evolved its approach through multiple instances of racism and a 2009 accusation of sexual assault. Pizzi says mental health professionals who have worked with the same contestants over many years are on call 24 hours a day during filming, and counseling is available once production wraps. If producers see cast members order what they deem to be too much alcohol, they get cut off. On April 2, 2023, Vanderpump Rules star Rachel Levis entered inpatient mental health treatment for 3 months following a season on which her affair with a castmate known as Scandoval became the show's central plot line and a national news story. Despite Bravo's knowledge of Levis's residential care, Cohen subsequently declined to correct Levis's castmates on multiple episodes of WWHL when they said she was actually at a spa and implied she was faking her mental health issues. Cohen also repeatedly asked what guests thought about Levis and her mental health. Saturday Night Live star Chloe Fineman called her a filthy whore, and Cohen laughed. After the reunion, he speculated in a Variety interview that Levis had been very medicated at the taping, during which her co-star Ariana Madix, whose ex-boyfriend Levis had the relationship with, told Levis, "F yourself with an effing cheese grater." Cohen did not intervene. "You can't be the leader of the universe, then act like you don't know what's going on in it," Frankel says of Cohen. "I was part of it," Frankel says. "I wanted to be Andy's favorite. I loved that I was Andy's favorite. I loved that I was able to make good television and produce it at the same time. I loved that producers knew I was the best. I was in the machine. I was the machine. I created the machine." Of her new mission to remake the medium that made her, Frankel says, "It's my penance." Presented with the idea that she might participate in Frankel's organizing, William said, "F Bethany Frankel, you think I'm going to let some white girl speak for me with my experience with a multi-billion-dollar corporation?" On September 22, 2023, after Vanity Fair began discussing this story with representatives from Warner Brothers Discovery and NBC Universal, NBCU Entertainment Chairman Francis Berwick sent a message to production partners. The message included a new alcohol policy. Building on our current protocols, we will require that you deliver an expanded alcohol-related training to the cast, crew, and production team. Berwick also wrote about enhanced mental health support, including on-set psychological support during and after filming and at reunions, as well as care after filming. According to the memo, there will reportedly be an on-set HR representative for shows where NBCU determines additional support may be warranted. And a Bravo representative told Vanity Fair there will also be a daily communication to NBCU, separate and apart from general production notes, flagging any health, safety, or respect issues that have arisen to quickly address concerns. 4 days before Berwick's memo went out, Bravo had aired an episode of The Real Housewives of Salt Lake City on which Gay drank espresso martinis until she vomited, urinated. It was unclear what fluid was pouring out of Gay and onto the floor of the Sprinter van. Cohen was there to quiz her about it on the episode of Watch What Happens Live that aired September 26th. Then he handed her an espresso martini to sip as punishment if she declined to answer any questions during a drinking game. 1 day later, on September 27th, the surprise guest on WWHL was Ramona Singer. Cohen pulled her onto his lap, embracing her. On October 23rd, Cohen teased that Singer was going to appear on WWHL again. She sat in the front row of the audience, and the drinking game word of the night was Ramona. Her name was uttered 8 times. As this story went to press, Singer was still scheduled to appear on a panel at BravoCon on November 5th. "I want to burn it down," one housewife told me in March. "I don't," I said. "I still hope there's a way to keep making Bravo shows without cast members feeling they've ruined their lives. Can't humanity be made into entertainment humanely?" I put this to another housewife, the one who dreamed of being famous. "I take umbrage with humanely," she says. "Have you ever seen what it takes to train a Navy SEAL or to become a professional athlete? There's nothing humane about the process to do it. And there's nothing humane about the game of football. And I effing love it." Now here's a Vanity Fair spotlight, Venice by Starlight, with photograph by Brett Lloyd. Labor strikes may have dulled the Hollywood firmament this autumn, but the 80th Venice International Film Festival shone as bright as ever as actors and legends gathered to celebrate Giorgio Armani's first show in the floating city. Venice means extraordinary atmosphere, history, romance, Armani says. It is incredibly beautiful. Everywhere you look captivates. For his one-night-only Venezia event, the 89-year-old designer took over the imposing Arsenal and mounted a runway show inspired by his love of the city. Vanity Fair and friends were there to mark the moment. In the photo, Roger Jean Page, Normandie Asamoah, Ava DuVernay, Sadie Sink, Kerry Washington, Kerry Condon, Giorgio Armani, Benicio del Toro, Sophia Loren, Sasha Alexander, Lily Reinhart, Camila Mendes, Mark Ronson, and Grace Scummer. Photographed at the Arsenal in Venice, September 2, 2023. The Ascendant. Jesmyn Ward, double National Book Award winner and best-selling author, returns to fiction with the haunting, beautiful Let Us Descend by Leah Fay Cooper, with photographs by Akasha Rabut, styled by Kaya D. Gooseby. Opening photo, Southern Gothic. Jesmyn Ward in her coastal hometown of Delisle, Mississippi, in September. As extraordinary ideas often do, the one for Jesmyn Ward's latest novel came to her in the most ordinary of ways. More than 7 years ago, the prolific author was driving from her home in Delisle, Mississippi, population 1,712, to New Orleans, where she's a professor of English at Tulane University. I was listening to the local NPR station, which is WWNO out of New Orleans, and they were doing a series celebrating New Orleans' tricentennial. So 300 years of New Orleans history and New Orleans culture, she says. Of all that, Ward absorbed from the 64-episode series, which ran from 2015 to 2018, and expounded on everything from the legacy of gay carnival to Germans introducing the city to gymnastics, she was most enthralled by a segment on the city's role in the American domestic slave trade. Ward grew up frequently visiting relatives in New Orleans, and her father lived there for several years when she was a teenager. Her upbringing, education, and career have minted her an ardent student of the Deep South. Yet, I was shocked that I knew none of the history that they were covering in the radio show, she says. And that, I think, really drove home for me the fact that history had been erased, so erased from the landscape that I had spent years of my life in that place and couldn't see that history at all. I just remember being appalled in that moment and wondering, what if I wrote about it? Would that help to bring that reality back into the public consciousness, back into the public awareness? And thus, Let Us Descend was born. A searing and vivid work of historical fiction, Let Us Descend tells the harrowing, heartbreaking story of Annis, a young enslaved woman brutally shepherded from the Carolinas to Louisiana after her enslaver, who is also her father, sells her to a sugar plantation. Not long before, he sold her mother away from her. The book is Ward's fourth novel and seventh published work. Her 2008 debut, Where the Line Bleeds, charts the lives of poor black twin brothers raised by their blind grandmother, and navigating life amid impossible circumstances. Ward followed it with Salvage the Bones, 2011, an account of a family's plight during Hurricane Katrina, inspired by her own family's experience. And Sing, Unburied, Sing, 2017, centered around a road trip to Mississippi's notorious Parchman Prison. Her nonfiction works include the memoir Men We Reaped, 2013, and the essay and poetry collection The Fire This Time, A New Generation Speaks About Race. Both Salvage the Bones and Sing, Unburied, Sing won the National Book Award for Fiction, making Ward the only woman and only African-American to win it twice. All set in the fictitious Mississippi Gulf town Bois Sauvage, Ward's first three novels explore themes that the native Mississippian knows intimately: poverty, oppression, racism, and grief, family, strength, community, and hope. The first person in her family to attend college, Ward graduated from Stanford in 1999 with a BA in English and earned an MA in Media Studies and Communications there in 2000. Shortly after finishing her master's, her brother Joshua was hit and killed by a drunken driver back home in Mississippi. The driver, who was white, was only charged with leaving the scene of the accident, not for her brother's death, and ultimately served just 2 years of a 5-year sentence. Ward spent 2 decades writing through that grief, during which she earned an MFA from the University of Michigan. Then, the devastation of loss struck again. Her husband, Brandon R. Miller, died in January 2020 from acute respiratory distress syndrome. He was 33. Part of what is so difficult about grief is attempting to find a new normal, attempting to figure out what your life is going to be day in, day out, without this person that you still love so much, she says. Sitting in her home office against a backdrop of floor-to-ceiling bookshelves, much of the past 3 years since my partner died have been about me attempting to figure out what that new normal looks like, she says. You don't stop loving that person just because they're not there. Ward once again wrote through her anguish, but took a departure from the present, instead bringing Let Us Descend to life in the antebellum South. Both the time period and subject matter are polarizing. Some argue that it's unnecessary for the horrors of slavery to be continually depicted in television, film, and literature. While Ward shaped Annis's story, she wondered if there was room for it, especially given two other fictitious works exploring slavery, Colson Whitehead's The Underground Railroad, 2016, and Ta-Nehisi Coates's The Water Dancer, 2019. Both Ward and Coates are Vanity Fair contributing editors. She could hear the public response to Let Us Descend in her head. Oh, not another slave narrative. When Ward explained her doubts to Coates, he responded with their shared belief that every enslaved person has a story to tell. All of them were people with wants and needs and desires. Given her Southern roots, lived Black experience, and mastery of language, few writers are better suited to tell those stories than Ward. I grew up in Mississippi, she says, her accent even more telling than her words. The agenda that they're pushing in Florida right now, saying that slavery was a good thing because it taught enslaved people valuable life skills. I encountered that rhetoric the whole time that I was in school from my classmates, Ward says. She wants to push back on that erasure. Otherwise, she adds, people will rewrite those stories to meet their own ends. Among fallacies Ward aims to confront with Let Us Descend is the myth of the passive slave. When I began writing this book, she explains, I'd be on social media. Then something contentious regarding race would happen. And somebody would say, I'm not my ancestors, right? Like, oh, we're not our ancestors. We're going to fight. So the underlying assumption is that they didn't fight. Though Ward knew that to be untrue, the 2 years she spent researching, poring over nonfiction books like Slavery's Metropolis by Roshana Johnson, The Half Has Never Been Told by Edward E. Baptist, and Walter Johnson's Soul by Soul, were mitigating. Slavery's Exiles by Sylviane A. Diouf remade my understanding of all the ways that enslaved people resisted, all the ways that they pushed back against this system that spanned the entire world. The details of Annis's story, the fact that her maternal grandmother was an African warrior, the indignities she faced on the trek from the Carolinas to Louisiana, how she coped with and fought against the realities of her life, were all realized, as Ward wrote. I am not the fiction writer or the kind of novelist who can plot everything out or who knows everything about their characters before they start, she says. I tried to work that way once. I tried to know a lot about my characters and outline and then write from that. I got 3 chapters into my first novel, and then I was like, okay, this doesn't work. Her writing is a process of discovery. When she began writing Let Us Descend, all she knew of Annis was that she was enslaved. With so many misconceptions about slavery permeating public discourse, Ward sought to render Annis as accurately and wholly as she has contemporary protagonist, with the same love and respect and tenderness and complication. One of those complexities is Annis's relationship with the supernatural. A theme Ward first explored in Sing Unburied Sing. This place always seemed to harbor spirits, Ward says, of her tiny hometown, where she grew up listening to relatives tell stories of the mystical and magical. She has always believed them to be real, and thus the spirit that connects with Annis is too. This is not a figment of her imagination. This is not mental illness. This is actually a spirit in the world that she's encountering. Were it not for that spirit, Ward is unsure if Annis's would have come to fruition. Part of me has to believe that there is something more for them and for us, right? Because if I didn't believe that there was something more, then I would just despair, and then I wouldn't be able to bear witness in my work at all. The idea of bearing witness to the unimaginable is one Ward revisits in life and work. Her essay on witness and Respair, a personal tragedy followed by pandemic, which was published in the September 2020 issue of Vanity Fair, guest edited by Coates, recounts the final moments of her husband's life as she watched doctors try to save him. In it, she writes, "If the person I love has to endure this, then the least I can do is stand there. The least I can do is witness. The least I can do is tell them over and over again, aloud, I love you. We love you. We ain't going nowhere." There is a scene in Let Us Descend where Annis listens as her friend and lover is raped. It's the type of passage that may prompt the reader to take a break. It's not easy. And I don't want to give the impression that I witness everything, Ward says, of the parallel between the experience she had and the one she wrote. But I do witness what I can. I really believe that witnessing is an act of love. Let Us Descend is dedicated to Ward's brother and her late husband. They taught me so much about grief and about what it means to love someone and then lose them, she says, and then to live afterwards with that love and with that loss. Though the book was garnering praise from critics before it even hit shelves, as a writer, Ward identifies more with the young woman she was while struggling to find a publisher for Where the Line Bleeds. I got a $6,000 advance for that book, she says. It sold a decent amount of copies. I definitely made my advance back, but it wasn't a big debut novel. None of the big important critics reviewed it. In retrospect, she's thankful for the humble beginning. That was a very grounding experience. I think it's one of the reasons that I identify with underdogs so much, because I think that especially in this industry, I've often felt like an underdog, like this person who is just getting it out of the mud. That Ward would go on to win 2 National Book Awards and a litany of other accolades was completely unexpected. I didn't even ask my mom or anybody from my family to take off from work to go with me to the NBA ceremony for Salvage the Bones, because I was like, I'm going to lose. When that didn't happen, it was a pleasant surprise, a pleasant shock, but it felt like an anomaly. The reality of Ward's success slowly began to sink in following her 2nd history-making National Book Award, but she'd rather not have any daily reminders of it. My NBAs and any of the awards that I get, I bring them all to my mom's house, she says. It is helpful for me not to have those in here where I work, so that I'm less aware of the fact that I've done all these things, she says. And she can do her work with a little less obsession over audience. Following the death of her husband, Ward became the sole parent to their 2 children, who turn 11 and 7 this year. In late 2022, she welcomed a 3rd, who was a total surprise, she says. The author is aware of the appearance that she's thriving, both personally and professionally. And while that's true to some extent, the whole picture of her life is far more nuanced. There are some people who see that I am in a new relationship, that I have had a child, and people just make these assumptions about grief, she says. They just assume that I'm over the death of my partner, and everything is A-OK again, and everything's all sunshine and roses, and it's not. I still wake up every day and miss my partner and the life that I had. Maintaining her career while caring for herself and her family is an ongoing challenge. I feel like some days I don't manage well at all. Thank goodness that I have a psychiatrist and I go to therapy. I think often that that is one of the only ways that I'm staying afloat. Being home in small-town Mississippi helps, too. Delisle is teeming with the oppression and lack of opportunity that Ward portrays in her work, and there are days when she tells herself, I don't know how much longer I can stay in this place. But if she's choosing to write about the kind of people that could be her siblings or aunts or cousins or friends, she says, being in Mississippi keeps her honest, and it's given her one of a writer's most cherished gifts. This place taught me to sit very still and to observe and to listen and then to take what I observed and to translate that into language, she says. This place taught me poetry. vintage royal. Cecil Beaton photographed the Windsors for more than 50 years, helping establish their legacy in the public eye. A new book from the Victoria and Albert Museum offers an intimate view of his myth-making work. Between 1927 and 1979, barely a year went by in which a member of the royal family was not the subject of Cecil Beaton's enchanting lens. By Claudia Acott Williams. More concerned with his idea of the person than the person themselves, the photographer transformed his subjects, and his romantic, reverential vision would help shape the image of the British monarchy in the mid-20th century. In the 1960s and 70s, Beaton's style evolved to reflect the changing mood of the time, and he adopted a more matter-of-fact and bold aesthetic. His presentation of motherhood in particular helped generate an emotional affinity between the royal family and the public. Yet he was still firmly associated with an opulence and artifice that spoke of an earlier era. Employed primarily at moments of celebration and ceremony, Beaton's photographs were undoubtedly intimate, able to capture a clear sense of the individuals behind the public image, but they were rarely spontaneous. Rather, their affected poses and considered context acknowledged the splendor and status of the institution, but with a generosity of spirit that invited the viewer to share in the fantasy. These photographs are adapted from Cecil Beaton, The Royal Portraits by Claudia Acott Williams, copyright 2023, Victoria and Albert Museum, London, Thames and Hudson, London, reprinted by permission of Thames and Hudson. In the photos, Palace Confidential, Queen Elizabeth II sat for portraits with Cecil Beaton many times over the course of her life. Pictured here with Beaton, November 1955, and images from October 1968. Behind the scenes. Coronation Day, the new queen in the green drawing room at Buckingham Palace, seen with Beaton and his assistants. The backdrop depicts the interior of Westminster Abbey's Lady Chapel, built during the reign of Henry VII, June 2, 1953. Princess Margaret, to mark her 19th birthday, July 1949. Queen Elizabeth, Prince Andrew, age 4, and Prince Edward, age 2 months. Children give the palace the sense of reality that necessarily it lacks, said Beaton, May 1964. Crowning moments. Princess Margaret at Buckingham Palace and Christian Dior Couture to mark her 21st birthday. When photographing Princess Margaret, I was conscious of how amused Her Royal Highness was by my antics, Beaton wrote, July 1951. Margaret, Lord Snowdon, and Beaton at Kensington Palace, July 1965. A portrait of Queen Elizabeth, selected from Beaton's only commission for a postage stamp, with a contact sheet from the sitting, October 1968. Shades of Stardom. Sandra Hüller is in two riveting films this awards season, the moral thriller Anatomy of a Fall and the Holocaust drama The Zone of Interest. The German actor isn't after the spotlight, but she may not have a choice. By David Canfield, with photographs by Emma Summerton, styled by Carolina Orrico. Sandra Hüller was photographed October 2nd in Los Angeles. The lauded German comedy Toni Erdmann features Sandra Hüller singing what has to be the most triumphantly awkward performance of greatest love of all in cinematic history. Hüller's Ines, a closed-off corporate consultant living in Bucharest, spends nearly 3 hours on screen enduring the outrageous pranks of her estranged father as he re-enters her life to lighten her up and strengthen their bond. His climactic stunt, fooling Ines into taking on an American classic at a Romanian stranger's Easter party, risk her total humiliation. Stiff in a white button-down and black blazer, trying to bury her thick German accent, she stumbles into the song, while her father, donning a ridiculous wig and false teeth, plays piano beside her. A few minutes in, she's all but screaming the lyrics. This emotional crescendo, so fully earned in Hüller's embracing turn, marks the moment that a generational talent revealed herself. Hüller was in her late 30s then, with more than a decade of film credits behind her. Still, Toni Erdmann brought her to the U.S. for the first time ever, thanks to a successful push for a Best International Film Oscar nomination. Fans here had no idea who she was and treated her like a discovery. It all seemed to promise a bright, glitzy future as a movie star. But nothing happened after, Hüller says now from her home in Germany. Not a shred of disappointment in her voice. It can just be over in a minute, and that's okay. Hüller does not carry herself like a campaigner, even though the noise around her has been about 10 times what it was 7 years ago. She has not one but two movies with critical love and Oscar buzz in Justine Triet's moral thriller Anatomy of a Fall and Jonathan Glazer's Holocaust drama The Zone of Interest. Initially, Hüller acts as if not much is going on at all, which seems hard to believe. She remains grounded in conversation, committed to the idea that the excitement will fade. She won't get sucked into the system. Her actual life has nothing to do with this. She does not see stardom as her calling, but the spotlight has fallen on her all the same. Since both films are international productions, not covered by SAG-AFTRA, which stayed on strike through all of the fall's major festivals, she was one of few contenders who could publicly present her work to some of the industry's most powerful tastemakers. She worries the many plaudits coming her way now have a bit to do with such an advantage. I'm not sure if I would have had that attention, if everybody would have been able to come. Either way, she deserved the acclaim. Both Anatomy and Zone debuted in Cannes in May, taking home the festival's Palme d'Or, first place, and Grand Prix, second place, respectively. Between the two movies, Hüller showcases an astounding range. She acts extensively and seamlessly in three languages, veers between defiantly human and mundanely evil, holds tight close-ups and long tracking shots, and meets the complex demands of two characters unlike any she's ever taken on. She could conceivably receive Oscar nominations for both titles. Running in lead for Anatomy and supporting for Zone, which Hüller knows requires a bit of extra legwork on the awards trail. I don't feel adjusted to it at all, she says. Our last and longest Zoom chat takes place 2 weeks after she's returned from a short trip to Telluride, where both of her movies again screened to great fanfare. She's now back home in Germany, where she lives with her 12-year-old daughter, regularly taking five-hour train rides to play Hamlet on stage in Bochum, while also starring in a stage adaptation of the 1962 film The Exterminating Angel. Is it overwhelming, balancing all the commitments? We manage, she says. Does the amount of work that goes into a major Oscar push start to feel like too much? Not really. I only go to events when I really have to. When I'm there, I enjoy it, and then I'm out of the attention zone. To get to know Uller as a person is not unlike getting to know her on screen, not unlike watching her belt out some Whitney Houston after barely raising her voice for the preceding 2 hours. She doesn't rush in the expression of big feelings of what's going on inside, but when she gets there, she doesn't hold back. Nobody seems to know this better than Justine Triet, whose superb Anatomy of a Fall offers Uller the role of a lifetime. Triet conceived the tricky character study with Uller in mind, naming the film's lead character Sandra about a year before even sending the actor the script. They'd met on Triet's previous movie, 2019's Sibyl, in which Uller portrayed a caustic, unraveling filmmaker. Triet understands what has been apparent about Uller's screen presence since her breakout role in 2006's Requiem. She takes her time. She's always playing a character, but her way of conjuring that character always seems like she's bringing it very, very close to herself, Triet says. There's something that transcends the script. In Anatomy of a Fall, Uller plays a German writer living in France whose husband has fallen from their home's upper story window to his death. Sandra becomes a suspect and stands trial. The dizzyingly twisty inquiry sweeping up her protective young son, Daniel, Milo Machado Graner, and her suave attorney, Vincent Swan Arlo. Triet's script never asserts guilt or innocence, but uses the framework of a legal drama to examine the brutal interrogation of one's identity, down to the language he speaks. Uller spoke French in the courtroom scenes, despite not being fluent, just as Sandra does. Like Sandra, Uller is also comparatively fluent in English. It's very much a film about the audience and what their perspective is on a successful woman, on a bisexual woman, on all these things, Uller says, and how the thoughts on her change with every information they get. The actor herself felt that push and pull, asking Triet early on whether Sandra was guilty. Triet had no answer, but asked that Uller play her as an innocent. Uller reveals everything and nothing about Sandra at the same time. Anguish and pride and grief and dashes of wicked humor infuse her portrayal. But she holds back, even as Sandra argues she has nothing to hide. You sense she doesn't want to be figured out, that she doesn't owe the world her deepest self. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.